then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more door for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. From many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's May the 3rd, 2012. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, as things have worked out, I'm really jammed up this week. I've got this week's Radio Free Northwest and next month's Northwest Observer slamming into exactly the same 3-day period when I got to get both of them done and on the air and in the mail. I believe I mentioned last week that both of the part-time assistants I've had helping me have had to cut back their hours here because they actually got real jobs. Now that's the fall to the damn Northwest economy. It's too good. White people can still get jobs here, damn it. Plus, Sally was in Spokane this weekend, and add to that the fact that I pretty much lost Monday because I had to spend most of the day in the city taking care of some things. So the result is that right now I'm really choked for time. Now, that usually means that I slap together a show using mostly clips from my hard drive, and you're going to hear a lot of those on this episode. But this week, because I'm so pressed for time and I really need to get a show on the air quick so that I can get back to stapling bulletins and stuffing envelopes, I'm going to cheat. Now, this is the 119th episode of Radio Free Northwest, which means that there are 118 of them before this, and I know darn well that all of you haven't been able to download and listen to all those shows. So I'm going to make like a major television network and give you a rerun or two this week. I'm going to pull a few clips of me ranting and raving from some of the earliest RFNs and covering some of the same subjects I'd probably be covering anyway since I do a lot of spaced repetition. I know this is sloppy practice, and I promise you that I will not make a habit of resting on my laurels, so to speak, but every now and then I'm sorry I just can't resist the temptation.
Here we are for podcast number 6 in the Radio Free Northwest series. I've gotten a few complaints about my talking too fast in past podcasts, and yeah, on listening into them, I think sometimes I do come across as a bit of a motor mouth, but that motor mouth effect is at least partly due to the sound editing that I have learned to perform on my WavePad program to cut out all the E's and uhs and ers and the coughing and the heavy breathing and the lip smacking and so forth. Nonetheless, it's a valid point, and I'll try to work on my delivery and improve the overall presentation in the future. Now, our first question for part one of this podcast is from Ed Peacock in North Carolina, and it reads as follows. Dear Harold, in your monologue on paranoia last week, you talked about exercising a few simple precautions to deal with paranoia in our day-to-day lives and in our racial work, but you were short on specifics. What simple precautions were you referring to? Good point, Ed. You're right. I did mention that. And then I went off rambling and lost the thread of what I was talking about, which is another problem I need to watch on these broadcasts. Okay, call these a few simple and reasonable security precautions to keep white racial activists functioning in society. Number 1. My recommendation is that you avoid big meetings, fests, conferences, where anybody with a pale skin can just walk in the door. The FBI and the SPLC love big racial and right-wing meetings to death. These events are happy hunting grounds for every kind of police agent, undercover reporter, or filmmaker looking to write smear stories on us, and also for every kind of left-wing private monitoring group spy you can imagine. These meetings in compounds or in rented motel banquet rooms are where most of our people first get onto the enemy databases. They get their license plates jotted down in the parking lot. They get identified and maybe photographed in a conference hall or on some compound or whatever by the cameras with the long-range telephoto lenses. And from then on, they're in the system. And one day being in the system may kill you. The enemy wants to know who we are. They want us in the database as preparation for that great day in the future when they can finally round us all up. That's the big wet dream for the FBI and Morris Dees and Mark Potok. They want to do to any white person utterly right of center what was done to people of German, Italian, and Japanese descent during World War II. People like Obama and Pelosi and Dees want us all in camps where no doubt our brains can be washed squeaky clean. And if that sounds like paranoia, I repeat, read your history books. They did it once before in 1941, and they're doing it now to naturalized U.S. citizens of Arab descent. They have the laws on the books now, like the Patriot Act and the Military Commissions Act of 2006, and one day they're finally going to spring the master plan and carry out the dream of all tyrants to lock up their opposition in prison. Alexander Solzhenitsyn called these people the organs of state security, or just the organs, and that's what I call them. FBI, Secret Service, DHS, CIA, BATFE, U.S. Marshals, and all the other spy agencies. And that includes the so-called private ones like ADL and the SPLC. Now, once the organs get a name and a photograph, they start a file on you, and you're in the database forever. Now, to be sure, most of us listening to this little podcast already have government and SPLC files on us, but that doesn't mean that we need to help them keep those files up to date. Make the bastards work. Put them to some effort. History proves that the best revolutionary results are always obtained by small autonomous groups, cells, whose members know each other and trust one another from experience. Yeah, most revolutions end up with mobs in the street in their final phase, but putting those mobs in the street is the work of many years of preparation by those small cells I just mentioned. Whether the Northwest Revolution or War of Independence will ever include a mobs in the street phase, I don't know, but I kind of doubt it. The fact is that American whites have been pretty much engineered out of the whole street mob mentality. But we'll see how that works out when the time comes. Now, getting back to my primer on paranoid practices, secondly, like my old movement mentor, Pastor Bob Miles, used to tell me, never write down or say on the telephone anything you wouldn't want read out in open court, because it probably will be. Nowadays, that applies to emails, chat rooms, podcasts like this, and all the other paraphernalia of the internet. Always assume that your electronic communications are being monitored and recorded by the organs of state security, and be aware of the fact that you may find yourself sitting in a courtroom someday, listening to your own words being played back to you. And when you're online or on the phone, assume that it's all for the record. Condition yourself never to say anything that might give the enemy an excuse to defunctionalize you. And then simply drive on. This is the 21st century. Practically speaking, we have no choice. We have to communicate with one another, and we have to use electronic means to do so. Choosing our words carefully and sanitizing our emails and telephone conversations needs to become second nature for us all. Point number three. At this time in the struggle, you should assume that anyone who proposes illegal activities, or just as importantly, anyone who refuses to shut up about illegal activities, is a cop. He's either a cop or he is someone who is so mentally unstable or so bird-brained stupid that he cannot recognize the difference between my fiction and reality, and so he's just as dangerous to have around. On more than one occasion in my career, I've seen men and women go to prison not for doing anything, not even for saying anything, but for simply being in the same room with somebody who would not shut up about planting bombs or assassinating people or blowing up bridges, whatever. And it turned out there was a funny little man over in the corner with a funny little tape recorder beneath his coat, and we know what happens then. One of these days I may tell you guys about the Asheville 6 case back in 1980, which is one of the prime examples of the very thing I'm talking about. Point number four. Avoid drunks, drug users, and anyone who is clearly mentally and emotionally unstable. Okay, this is 2010, and let's face it, almost all white people are a little dysfunctional these days. Goes with the territory of living in a completely unnatural world. But you need to stay away from people who are really badly damaged, and it usually doesn't take too long to figure out who those are. Always choose quality over quantity. Never try to get mileage out of creeps. Historically, that is one of the worst mistakes movement groups have ever made, and I know because I've made that mistake a few times myself. Point number 5, know the ground rules, insofar as there are any, which in our case isn't very far. You need to understand that you are white, and that means that in politically correct society, you have no rights. Always be aware of the fact that white nationalists are a persecuted minority without any real legal protection in this society, and we are pretty much at the mercy of the regime and its agents. And they will, in the end, do to us whatever the hell they feel like doing. And why should they not? White men no longer have any deterrent. Why should they not arrest us, frame us, torture us in jail, crucify us with their judicial system, send us to prison for non-existent crimes, destroy our families and destroy our lives? Who's going to stop them? Not us. But let's be honest, framing and persecuting and destroying so-called white supremacists is the safest thing the government and the private liberal vigilante groups do. They put Glenn Miller in the witness protection program for many years, true, but that was just for show, to make him more credible as a witness to dumbass juries, which they failed to do, by the way. I think we all know that Glenn was never in any danger, despite testifying in 2 capital cases against his own people. Now, the government and its enforcement agencies are not going to play fair with you. Morris Dees and Abe Foxman and Mark Potok are not going to play fair with you. There is an old Sicilian proverb, never ask for what you can't take. The old Constitution is gone. Bush threw it out the window and Obama pissed on it down in the alley where it fell. We have only whatever rights we can force these people to grant us. Lacking any deterrent, lacking any way to compel the government and the police and the private liberal monitoring groups to respect our right to differ from them and respect our right to dissent and to think for ourselves, all we can do is go crawling on our bellies to these people with our tails thumping between our legs, begging these people to show us mercy, to be kind, and give us our rights. Look around you and see how well that's working out for us. Even as I speak these words, the Democratic Party is about to ram socialized medicine down the throats of white America and hand 1/6 of the U.S. economy over to themselves through the use of a parliamentary trick called reconciliation, and this after white America has spent the past year making it abundantly clear that we don't want it. All the town hall meetings and the tea parties and the faxes to congressmen and the phone calls to Rush Limbaugh are simply being ignored. As Barack Hussein Obama and Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid extend their middle fingers and say, "Screw you, America." Now tell me again about all these rights we supposedly have. Tell me again what a great free country this is supposed to be. Until such time as white men decide that their honor and their self-respect demands that they once again be willing to incur personal risk and danger in order to take back our rights from those who will never give them to us willingly, then we have none. Okay, music break yet? Now let's do another question from someone who describes himself as a well-known VNN poster. And since VNN people aren't supposed to be in direct contact with me, and he doesn't want to get in trouble and maybe banned or sent to the Nutspaw Lounge or Tard Corral or whatever, he asks that he remain anonymous. Okay, fair enough. Anonymous VNN guy's question is, "Dear Mr. Covington, I notice in the Northwest Republic's Constitution that you post on your website that you include in your Bill of Rights the right to free medical care. That sounds suspiciously socialist. How does this differ from the Obamacare that's about to be rammed through Congress?" To begin with, I need to remind all of you that the draft Constitution, dated October 2006, which is published in the party handbook and on the party website, is just that. It is a draft. The actual form that the Constitution of the new Northwest Republic will take will be decided at the appropriate time by a constitutional convention consisting of those who have brought the Northwest Republic into being, just as was done before. Remember, the United States Constitution wasn't created until 1787, 6 years after the end of the First American Revolution. Now, this draft we have now is not just something that Harold made up. It was created through actual consultation with many individual people, including some of the order prisoners, and including David Lane himself during its early stages. The Northwest Constitution, as it now stands, is meant to give us some kind of benchmark as to exactly what it is we're fighting for, and to show white people that we're not just a bunch of crazy guys with shaven heads and tattoos, but that we do, in fact, have real ideas for an alternative to politically correct society. But it is only a draft, a series of suggestions, if you will. It's not chiseled in stone. When the time comes, the veterans of the revolutionary struggle, whatever form that struggle may take, are going to have to sit down around a table or in the National Convention and decide for certain exactly what kind of government the white people of the homeland want. A lot of how that turns out is going to depend on how we finally end up attaining our independence and what the world of that time will be like, but that's another topic. All that having been said, a lot of what the Northwest Republic's constitution was designed to do was to correct a variety of abuses and injustices which have crept into American constitutional law over the past 230 years. A good example is eliminating the entire judicial branch of government so that the courts are reduced to their proper function of being finders of fact and not interpreters of law, and so we won't have a Supreme Court messing around with the Constitution like the nine old swine in D.C. have been doing for the past 100 years. Another of those injustices is that we have here today in America a situation where a working white family can lose their house if grandma or another family member gets sick. Private health insurance is disappearing, along with employment in this country. You can be sure that if the millions of white Americans who are now out of work ever do manage to get rehired at some job or other, it will be with substantially reduced medical insurance or no medical insurance at all, because private employers are getting ready to dump all their employees off onto Obamacare once Reid and Pelosi ram it through by misusing budget reconciliation, which should be in a few weeks' time. Why should employers pay for health insurance for their employees if the government provides it? The fact that the government won't be providing anything for at least 5 years means nothing to capitalists. They're going to dump all their people off onto a largely unproven and non-existent government health service long before it even exists. We really need to keep in mind that as bad as Marxism and liberalism are, capitalism is just the flip side of the same poisonous coin. As things stand right now, when grandma gets sick or mommy gets cancer, if the head of the household and other family members make too much money, then they're not eligible for what little government help is available, Medicare or Medicaid. White males aren't eligible for these programs anyway, which are run by the states. I know because I myself have tried to get on to the local version of Medicaid in both Washington and Oregon, and I was turned down by both states on grounds of my race and my gender. They didn't quite put it like that directly, of course. What they specifically told me was that I did not fit into one of the 15 or 16 eligibility categories. Of course, it just so happens that all of the eligibility categories apply solely to women, children, and racial minorities. The only way a white male can be eligible for medical insurance is to be actually blind, physically disabled, or over 65, which lets out most of us middle-aged white boys. What got me was that in Oregon, at least, illegal aliens are specifically included in one eligibility category, and don't get me started on that. Some years ago, one young black girl working for the Washington State version of Medicaid, Washington Basic Health, I think it's called, was refreshingly honest with me when I applied. She told me, "Mr. Covington, men of your demographic," by which she meant middle-aged white males, she said, "men of your demographic are supposed to be paying for this program, not drawing benefits from it." She wasn't being mean or racist to me. She was just simply telling me the facts of life, and I appreciated her honesty. Okay, I'm rambling again, so I'll try to get back on track. That provision in the Northwest Constitution is meant to prevent the situation which I and so many of our people face right now, and that is we are being denied medical care because we have no money. Don't ever let anyone tell you that no one is ever turned away from needed medical care in this country because they're poor. I know that's not true because it's been done to me in the past, and no doubt will be again. I'm not lying. Poor white people most certainly are turned away because they have no money, because I've had it happen to me. In the Northwest American Republic, in a white nation, a white homeland, that must not, will not, ever happen. Not to anybody, man, woman, or child, period, end of story. And if it means that in the Northwest Republic, doctors won't drive Porsches and live in 30-room mansions and spend their weekends on the golf course at the country club, then so be it. We will train our own doctors, paramedics, and healthcare professionals and make sure we instill in them motivations and ethics having to do with helping sick and injured people and not ringing the chink, chink, ching of a cash register. It's things like this that sometimes tempt me to give in to the urge to start on the fifth Northwest novel I mentioned a few weeks ago, the one that follows the first 50 years of the Northwest Republic's existence and explains just how all these problems could be and should be worked out. But again, that's just a digression, so I'll stick to the point. I will conclude by saying this. Like every other issue on this continent, the healthcare issue is immensely complicated by and intertwined with the issues of race. Obamacare is essentially a program to transfer wealth away from people with white skins and into the pockets of people with dark skins in the form of free medical care. In an all-white society, that problem would not apply. I can tell you that because I've actually lived in an all-white society, which was probably at the time the last remaining all-white society in the world except for Iceland. And that is Ireland back in the 1980s. I can tell you from personal experience that in an all-white society, a single-payer healthcare system works. My wife had two babies, and we all had the usual problems with childhood diseases and so on. I think there was something like a £5 copayment for a doctor visit and a couple of quid for prescriptions, and that was it. And if you had a full medical card, even the copayments were dropped. It's only when you get into a situation like California, where something like half the emergency room treatments are to non-paying illegal aliens who give false names and then disappear, combined with incredibly greedy pharmaceutical companies, and it's then you start having problems. Okay, first music break. I'm in a bit of a southern mood here, and you guys seem to like last week's banjo piece, so here's Tony Ellis with Doc Mongol's Blues.
Guys, this is Axis Sally, and again with the bullying. I saw another one of those anti-bullying ads, and again, I see nothing wrong with just encouraging people to be nicer to each other, but what I reject more than anything is this idea that we are all beautiful and unique snowflakes who are special in our own ways, and we need to be encouraged to follow our dreams and crap. Most of this does not need to be repeated. I think we all know that not all people are special and that a lot of so-called bullying is actually some whiny little bitch's precious feelings getting hurt when it's pointed out that his dreams are retarded. I'd like to expand more on the notion of uniqueness. I think it's a mistake to teach our children that they're unique and special, and anyone who doesn't see that is obviously some child hater with a very negative attitude. The thing is, most children are pretty much the same, and the whiny brat who screams in a public place is just that, a whiny brat who should have been left at home. It's not a special little snowflake exploring his special world, it's a damn noisy kid. I'm glad I have the ability to view my own children somewhat objectively. I remember after my oldest daughter was born, my husband kept going on about how intelligent she was, and all I could think was, based on what? She's a baby. She looks at stuff and screams. She's no more intelligent than any other baby. Today she's 10 years old and she somehow got into the gifted class, yet she broke an egg after taking it out of the fridge and sitting on it to try to hatch it, and she can't spell worth a damn, which is hugely embarrassing to me. Her sister isn't much better. I'm sure that if their father weren't a teacher, they'd be stuck in the regular class with all the regular kids, which, in my opinion, is where they belong until they can learn how to use an apostrophe correctly. I don't see anything wrong with being of average intelligence. I think that white people who lack skills or abilities in one area can make it up somewhere else. I see no shame in being a C student or having children who are C students. What's dumb is when the parents waste energy trying to convince the rest of the world that their children are somehow intellectually special so much that the school system just doesn't understand and it's everyone else who has the problem. No, just admit it. Your kid is average. What's wrong with that? I understand the idea of Aryan superiority and that we must try to breed only the best of the best, but even among the best, someone's going to be in the middle and someone's going to be the worst. If you take the 100 smartest white people in the world, one of them is going to be at the bottom of that list. Same with looks. White people are supposed to be the most physically attractive of all. Sure, my kids are pretty, but I've seen better. Maybe as mine get older, they'll get better looking, or maybe they'll stay at their current level of attractiveness. Either way is fine. Their cute, healthy white kids will one day produce more of the same. Again, even among the most attractive white people in the world, someone has to fall to the bottom of the list. Letting someone else know where they stand on that list is not necessarily bullying. I encourage all white women to have more children, but as crucial to our survival as these children may be, I will never be convinced that each and every one is so damn special. They're kids. They annoy people and do dumb things and probably aren't that good looking either. There's not one unique thing about any of this. Maybe wait until they're a little older and discover any talents or abilities they may have, but don't cry about what a bully everyone else is when they point out that your little snowflake is about as interesting as a dead fish. Like most kids, mine want to be pop stars and veterinarians and actresses and teachers. At some point, sensible white people grow out of their Neverland Ranch ideals and start planning for realistic futures, hopefully which involve learning to do their own laundry and getting out of their parents' basement before age 20. But other white people, usually the liberals and hipsters that are the subject of the book Stuff White People Like, believe the appropriate course of action is that which allows you to follow your dreams. You know, the dream that every special little child has about being a singer or fashion designer or getting paid to read stupid poems on open mic night at the coffee shop. Working an actual job that allows you to support yourself and raise a family is seen as wage slavery. What you really need to do is follow your dream because, darn it, you're worth it and you can do anything you set your mind to. No, you can't. And your kids can't because they aren't special. They're regular people who need to plan for regular lives. Ditch your dreams. Men, work 60-hour weeks doing backbreaking things you hate so you can support yourself and a family. Women, learn some kind of practical skill you can fall back on until you find someone who wants to reproduce with you. For some of you more average-looking types, this may take a while, so plan to spend some time learning to type or cut hair or wipe noses. Read your damn poems on your own time, and they better not be stupid ones about how bullied you are and how your life is like a purple lake of desolation. You're average. Get over it. I'm average. Most people are average. Even most of the greatest race to ever walk the earth is average. And I'll bet the first several people who respond with angry insistence that they're anything but average will misspell their heated rant.
All right, I have a confession to make. This week, I used some of the Spring Fund Appeal money to consult an attorney. According to him, it is very unlikely that the FCC is going to let up on us anytime soon with this ridiculous demand that on a white nationalist podcast, we have so-called diversity and community programming and whatever the hell they call it. And unless we can actually pay this shyster $20,000 up front, he's not even going to sue the FCC for us, and I think it would be a pointless exercise anyway. I'll have to see what else we can do about it. So once again this week, I went trudging over there to the projects in Rainier Valley. Dry ice, once again, is not available. He apparently is in Washington, D.C., testifying before a congressional committee headed by none other than Nancy Pelosi. on how he was racially profiled by the Seattle police, and he and Effie Sue need at least $2 million in compensation to heal their hurt feelings over his false arrest over the business with the chicken bones and the wine bottles. Anyway, once again, I had to get Effie Sue to step into the gap to give us our federally mandated African-American viewpoint.
Hello there, children. It's me, Effie Sue Washington here. And you know what? I've been wondering. Who the hell has got their hand up the media's ass these days? The other day I was watching a TV news program, and you know what they brought up? Rodney fucking King. Now, why the fuck do you think they would do that? Something that happened 20 fucking years ago. You know why. So do Effie Sue. They'd be expecting the same damn thing to happen in the Trayvon Martin case. And truth be knowing, the media probably hoping it will be. See, the media don't want nothing more than a bunch of fools going super turbo ape shit. Burning buildings, looting stores, killing innocent people, ranting and raving, pumping their fists in the air, screaming, "We go overcome!" You know when you go overcome? You go overcome when you learn to act like a fucking human being. Not some jungle ape who's had kerosene rubbed on his ass. It ain't nothing short of sick than watching the lazy asses in the media seduce the dumb asses wanting media attention. Oh, look at me. Look at me. I'm on TV. Yeah, fool. You on TV, all right. And you know who be watching? Somebody out there smarter than you rubbing their palms together saying, "Ooh, I'm gonna give me some of that fool's money." Why do you think we haven't seen nothing but pictures of poor little old 12-year-old Trayvon in his ski outfit? Poor little old 12-year-old wearing his school t-shirts. Hey! What happened to the tattooed Facebook and middle finger tweeting about the size of his dick, Trayvon? How come the media ain't been going on and on about that? You ever notice how things immediately got real quiet when the pictures of the back of the Mexican dude's head surfaced and there really was blood all over it? Don't think for one fucking minute that right now plans and preparations ain't being made for the upcoming trial of Trayvon. And I ain't talking about legal plans and preparations neither. I'm talking about that low-life reverend without a church, Jesse Jackson. And that reverend without a clue, Al Fat-Ass Sharpton. You ever wonder how these two fools make money without passing around a collection plate? Cause there'd be a country of dumbasses just willing to hand it over to them to help the cause. What cause, you ask? It don't matter. Whatever cause they choose at the time. Tragedy happened, you can look for Jess, Al, Spike Lee, and all them other attention-greedy type to show up and say, "Let's get along." Oh, yeah. These bling-wearing fools have made a fucking fortune of Rodney King, O.J. Simpson, Hurricane Katrina, Gina Louisiana, now Trayvon fucking Martin. Yeah, let's all just get along. What a fucking concept. You know, if we could all just get along, there wouldn't be no tragedy in the first place. You don't want people to get along. You want looting and shooting and mass chaos, because that way your low-life, lazy, good-for-nothing media friends will have a story without actually having to get off their ass and go fucking look for one. Think about it. When's the last time you saw anything on the evening news about how much it costs to put food in your belly or drawers on your nasty ass? Or how many people be out of work than ever before? Oh, sure. Ever goddamn loose-lipped, lying in their hip with taxpayer money type say, "I'm gonna put people back to work. I'm gonna create more jobs." When, motherfucker? I'm gonna tell you when. The day after election day. Cause we all got to be sure these low-life, out-of-work, don't-really-want-a-job, just-want-a-bitch-about-not-having-a-job, worthless pieces of shit can get to the polls and vote, 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 fucking vote your ass back in. And you can bet your sweet ass the media is hoping like hell that the Trayvon case will come to trial before election so they'll have something to talk about till then. And the politicians, well, they be hoping so too. Since the last thing them useless fuckers want us talking about is them. All the way from that useless half-wit in the White House down to the local dog catcher, there ain't nothing good to say about not a damn one of them. You and I both know what's gonna happen the minute the trial is over. Total fucking chaotic African-like tribal bullshit. Whether the verdict be innocent or guilty, it don't make no difference. So go on, get your cameras ready, boys and girls. This is most likely gonna be the greatest minstrel show you've seen since the days of slavery. Hope you fuckers enjoy it. Effie Sue Washington here. Peace out.
Greetings from Idaho. I'm going to go ahead and go by the name Satanta on my audio recording. This is because I already use this name on the Northwest Front forums. Satanta is a mythical figure in a Celtic tale who has the abilities to be a good, tenacious hero capable of fighting off worthy adversaries and coming up with clever methods to accomplish his goals when all else fails. I, however, don't yet fit this description completely. What Satanta and I have in common is that we were both from humble origins. I wasn't born into a wealthy family, and I've had to work in order to support myself. Nor have I been racially aware all of my life. It wasn't until early this year that I came to understand that I must also be working towards the betterment of my greater family, the white race. Currently, I am a college dropout who is majoring in philosophy for 2 years. I suppose I could complete this course of, should I call it, education? Let me call it Shadows on the Wall, created by puppet masters who deceive a group of chained-up residents who have never seen the light of day. That is, until most recently, as far as one of us is concerned. I am, of course, making a reference to Book 7 of Plato's Republic, the allegory of the cave contained therein. I probably hijacked the meaning of said allegory, but I find it to be one of those stories that can apply to many situations. One such situation is the Jew and multiculturalist hold on education and the media in our lands. Hopefully Plato's works are so well known that the metaphor I used is basically cliché, but it probably is not. This is yet another sign of how schooling and the media, which is continued education for many people, are misleading people in the same way as the shadow masters of Platonic birth. At college, I became acquainted with many works of philosophy, including ancient Greek. I also took several English courses and learned that, at least at my college, you were more likely to get a multiculturalist viewpoint in the English department, and a greater chance of blatant Zionism in a philosophy course, though the latter was rare, and to be honest, our philosophy club went on a leafleting tour of a few neighborhoods in support of liberals. At the time, I didn't really mind it. Now I remember it because of the then-humorous comment one of my professors made. While walking door-to-door, we were able to witness a man drive 2 blocks from his house to a gas station, come back, and exit his pickup truck with a case of beer. "How convenient. Only 2 blocks and you've got yourself some booze," was the gist of what the professor said. It was nice to know that even a PhD can make a comment like this about something so hysterical. But now when I look back on it, I don't see that situation as humorous because it was a sign of the moral decay of white people in America because of the Jews. It's the Jews. They have done so much that they can't escape the blame. I believe this is pretty evident to our community, so I won't bore you by repeating what has already been said. Nowadays, I still read some Nietzsche, Plato, Aristotle, and Dostoevsky, but I've realized that I need to get a job, and more importantly, a trade. I've had about 8 jobs so far in my life, and I'm not beyond my mid-20s. I've done home construction, security system installation, Starbucks. But I need to get a trade, so I've realized more so now that I've had a chance to listen to Harold Covington on Radio Free Northwest. So I'm working toward this goal, to become self-sufficient again instead of living in my mother's basement. Becoming an autotech is my current endeavor. So yes, I am currently a t-shirt youth. Single, male, unemployed, and somewhat dysfunctional. But like Harold said, you can't just come to the Northwest like this and expect to end up anywhere but a homeless shelter, or off in the corner of the university library during open all-night hours, resting on a beanbag chair the staff were so nice to have provided you with. You must have the ability to find gainful employment when you get here, and you must have the ability to get here and survive a few months without a job. Fortunately, I was born in the Northwest and still live here, which is somewhat of an exception. Nevertheless, I still live in my mother's basement, and I need to improve my economic condition. But since I live here, I feel entitled to ramp up the online propaganda efforts with this piece of audio. Now I want to share with you what contributed to me becoming racially aware. An acquaintance lent me an anthology of Celtic myths and legends. Since I am mostly English and Scottish, with some Irish and Welsh as well, I felt a satisfaction from reading about my ancestors' lore that I never felt when reading about the Jews in the Old Testament. Racial pride was awakened inside of me, and though I at first flirted with racialist ideas, I finally came to my senses when I sat down at the computer and did some real research about the niggers, kikes, and spics. Now I found justification for feeling superior to these other races. It wasn't just in my head. This is a real phenomenon. White civilization spread around the earth and helped evolve the other cultures into what they are today. Without us, they may well still have been hunter-gatherers, and I doubt they could have been anything other than this without us. Now take all the inventions of the white race, and we have the basis of white supremacism. I just bought the sagas of Icelanders to provide some background for myself because of my Germanic side, including Dutch and Anglo-Saxon. So far, I have found the works of these Nordics to be very direct and to the point, especially when the berserkers unleash themselves upon their foes. Hopefully this can become a motif of the Northwest Migration Movement, that is, being direct and getting to the point on the map within the Pacific Northwest before it's too late, and if need be, with the might of the fabled berserker. It's okay if you need to rest afterward. This is understandable since you may have overexerted yourselves in the process of getting here, much like a berserk is left weak after he has committed his superhuman rage. This is Satanta, a t-shirt youth, awakened at last and preparing for the Northwest Front. May my efforts be exceeded by the vast majority of racially aware whites.
Okay, you can probably tell I'm just slapping this one together as quickly as I can, but I do need to take some time to explain this second music break. Now, normally I would never, ever play on here anything by two so-called white rappers, but this is a kind of special case. There is method in my madness. Let me run this down for you. Back in 2009, there was an outbreak of Hebraic Sound and Fury at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, which, if you know anything about your modern political history, is one of the bluest pimples on any blue state anywhere. We're talking the Mount Olympus of hippy-dippy 60s retreads. Put it this way, most of the weathermen from the 1960s, when they got out of jail or got tired of milking goats down on the commune, they came and retired to Madison, Wisconsin, where they all run organic markets or head shops or commie bookstores or whatever. It's that kind of place. Okay, ever since about the mid-1990s on the campus at the university there, the kids have used a term called coastie, which is a derogatory term to denote female students who come from the East Coast. Coasties are basically rich girls from New York or Washington, D.C. or New England or maybe the blue areas of the South like Research Triangle Park in North Carolina. There are a number of stereotypes associated with this nickname. One is that coasties don't pay their own tuition because they come from very wealthy and privileged families. Liberal Democrat families, of course, since this is Madison. They live in private residence halls on campus, which somehow or other seem to have been set aside for them. Wonder how that happened. And they are supposedly all members of the same sororities. Their version of campus gear is supposed to be almost like a uniform, including North Face jackets and backpacks and UGG boots. They all hang out at the same places off campus, including a place called the KK. I'm not sure exactly what that is. It's a bar or a cafe of some kind, but apparently that's where all the coasties hang out after class. Oh, and by the way, one more thing. They're all supposed to be Jewish. Japs. Jewish American princesses. Now, not being a student there myself, I can't say how accurate this stereotype is, but apparently enough people on campus got it so that back in 2009, a couple of so-called white rappers were able to come up with this song that really pushed a lot of Jew buttons. It was called the Coastie Song, and it is sung, or mumbled would probably be a better word, by two emo-looking kids named Quincy Harrison and Clifford Gray for Griefy. Not sure how you pronounce that. Anyway, they call themselves Quincy and Beef. They did this song in their dorm room using some kind of music software that sounds about like it's on the same level of what I use, and they put it on the internet, and it must have really struck some kind of chord because it went viral. It ended up on MySpace. People were doing versions for YouTube, so forth and so on. Now, to make a long story short, all the Jews on campus went ballistic. Then the ADL started writing nasty letters to the university trustees trying to get these two white boys kicked out of college for anti-Semitism. And then the media got involved, yada, yada, yada. Now, some of you listening to this may remember all the twisting and shouting at the time. Now, a couple of things make this incident noteworthy. The first one is that while Quincy and Beef clearly are not white nationalists, and don't get me wrong, I'm not claiming that they are, the fact is that these are a couple of 21-year-old white boys from some place in rural Wisconsin who came to university, almost certainly the first time they've ever been around Jews, and they actually noticed Jewish behavior and were sufficiently irritated by it to make fun of the chosen ones. Now, I know that some of us older movement guys wonder sometimes if we have another generation coming up at all that we can pass the torch to and who will take up the burden of our ancient knowledge of these creatures, and sometimes we doubt it. But incidents like this Coastie Song thing are very encouraging. Looks like not all of the younger generation of white boys is completely deaf, dumb, and blind. Maybe it has something to do with this being the first generation raised by South Park. Secondly, what was interesting was the way in which the university and the guys themselves handled it. The university hemmed and hawed, but they did not throw the two boys out or discipline them in any way. And the two guys themselves, when they found themselves in the middle of a media feeding frenzy, basically just said, "Hey there, Hebrews, lighten up." And they got away with it. If whites will just stand up to political correctness and they don't have an immediate vulnerability like a job at stake, which the Jews can strike at right away, 9 times out of 10 the kikes will back down. Because while their bite can still be painful, it's nowhere near as bad as their bark. In fact, I have a theory that in some respects the Jewish establishment has actually been declining in power for the past 20 years or so. We won't get into that here. Anyway, without further ado, here is the first blossom of the South Park generation, our next generation of anti-Semites, the Coastie Song. Again, bear in mind the obscure references to North Face and Uggs and the KK actually do mean something to University of Wisconsin students.
Holla, what's good?
What's up, folks? I've been around campus and seen so many fine biddies. What are they wearing, though? I think they look good.
Oh, you're talking about them coasties, aren't you?
Wait, what?
What's a coastie? Black tights all day.
That's a coastie.
Starbucks, big shade.
She a coastie.
Always blowing daddy's money.
You a coastie.
My East Coast, you a shunny.
What's a coastie? A white TV neck.
That's a coastie.
She always think that she the best.
She a coastie.
American princess, baby, walks with the swag and talks so crazy. East Coast accent, East Coast fashion, black spandex with an ass like Bass. Smoking on the cig and she passes. Blackberry messaging, multitasking. Take off the glasses, let me see your face. It's a hot summer day, still rocking North Face. Got a Starbucks cup, yeah, you my star bucket. I know you live there, but I can really get you lucky. So I said, honey, be my lady. She said, KK, I'ma meet you with the KK.
What's a coastie? Black tights all day.
That's a coastie.
Starbucks, big shade.
She a coastie.
Always blowing daddy's money.
You a coastie.
My East Coast, you a shunny.
What's a coastie? A white TV neck.
That's a coastie.
She always think that she the best.
She a coastie.
North Face with the
You a coastie.
But I'ma still show some love.
Talking on this Sally like, girl, oh God. Coach bag, Gucci shades that they daddy bought. Mugging, wearing V-neck tees with the iPod. Always up in Van Black, I have a question. Baby, sit back, let me explain this lesson.
What's a coastie?
Black tights all day.
That's a coastie.
Starbucks, big shade.
She a coastie.
Always blowing daddy's money.
You a coastie.
My East Coast, you a shunny.
What's a coastie? A white TV neck.
That's a coastie.
She always think that she the best.
She a coastie.
North Face with the
You a coastie.
But I'ma still show some love.
Why the fuck are they even calling me a coastie? And not even from the fucking coast. From Chicago.
What's a coastie?
Black tights all day.
That's a coastie.
Starbucks, big shade.
She a coastie.
Always blowing daddy's money.
You a coastie.
My East Coast, you a shunny.
What's a coastie? A white TV neck.
That's a coastie.
She always think that she the best.
She a coastie.
North Face with the
You a coastie.
But I'ma still show some bad.
What's a coastie?
Coastie.
Coastie.
Elementary school student stabs two others, one dies. That's probably niggers. That's in Chicago.
Yeah.
Obama's uncle due in court on drunk driving charge.
Arrested for posing with rifle on Facebook.
Okay. This is an interesting story here. It says Ohio teen arrested after posing with gun, posting threats on Facebook, which is a stupid thing to do. But we have had some people here in the Northwest who got visits from our friends in the silk suits purely for posting pictures of themselves on the internet, Facebook, MySpace, that kind of stuff, holding a weapon or a rifle. We're supposed to have a Second Amendment in this country, but apparently if you actually reveal the fact that you practice the Second Amendment, you're going to get a visit. Anyway, let's see what it says.
Especially
here.
If you're racial.
Yeah. Just one day after a school shooting devastated Chardon High School in Ohio, a local teen was arrested after posting a new Facebook profile picture showing him posing with an assault rifle. Portage County Sheriff's Office apprehended the 17-year-old Crestwood High School student on Tuesday morning after several concerned citizens called in about the image. Okay, some of his posts also reportedly raised concerns. I'm close to going on a stabbing spree, okay, he said one post written on February 22nd, which, by the way, was before the Ohio thing. I can't take some of these people anymore, okay? He's posing with a rifle, but he's threatening to go on a stabbing spree. And by the way, First and Second Amendment, these are two guaranteed constitutional rights, and the kid gets arrested for practicing them. I can kind of understand why parents and teachers are concerned that some of these bullied white kids might finally snap and go shooting at the niggers and the assholes who bully them, since it does happen, but you would think that the ones you'd have to worry about would be the ones who bottle it all up and don't post it on Facebook. Let's put it this way. I've got a lot of experience with internet threats. And the ones that threaten me on my blogs and on the comments section of the blogs and email me threats, etc. I've been doing this, God, well, 40 years in one form or another. The few times that I have had personal physical trouble with people, not once did they ever threaten me in advance, either by phone or by email or anything like that. The ones that threaten and the ones that talk aren't the ones you have to worry about.
Yeah, generally they're cowards. They want to have an outlet for being able to sit there and just sputter and release their pent-up rage and their anger. And so they spew a bunch of stupid BS on Facebook. You know, when I was a kid, there was always some way to have an out. Whenever somebody was, you had trouble in school or whatever, there was always a way to deal with that. And now there's so many restrictions on being able to do stuff like beat the shit out of somebody who's causing you problems at school. So they start doing this stupid shit, you know, where they post on the Facebook and blogs and whatever, and they cry and they moan. And then, of course, they get all arrested. And I guarantee you, the other kid that did the Ohio shooting, guarantee you, he did not say anything about it. He just went and he did it.
You don't want to make any pro-bullying remarks? I suppose I should mention that Shenandy a few weeks ago made some pro-bullying comments, which I...
Bully him back!
Yeah, right. But apparently that got almost as many people upset as Sally and her cat stomping things. Guys, this is something of a free speech forum here. I don't necessarily agree with everything that's said on here. Everything that's said on here isn't necessarily Northwest Front policy. So let's lighten up a little bit and let's learn to accept the fact that when white people who aren't able to speak anywhere else on the face of the earth get behind this microphone, they tend to let loose. Don't sweat it, guys. Don't sweat the small stuff. Lighten up. Student social network page has allegedly been shut down. Okay, this is interesting. This kid is going to be charged. He's 17 years old. He will now face 2 counts of inducing panic.
That's illegal?
Apparently in Ohio it is. Inducing panic.
Oh my God, I'm going to have a panic attack. I'm going to have a panic attack.
Apparently, the law can be ridiculous at times. Like in North Carolina, we have some anti-Klan laws that go back to the Reconstruction when, regardless of what you think of the situation, the fact is the Klan was a real threat. They were riding around shooting people and hanging niggers and such. And one of the anti-Klan laws from that period forbids wearing a mask in public. And back in the 70s, some idiot nigger cop in Raleigh arrested a guy on the street who was wearing a gorilla suit and a mask. It was one of these things where he was doing advertisement for a car wash or something, and this idiot cop arrests him for wearing a mask in public.
I was going to say, that must play havoc with Halloween.
Well, everyone knows what the law was for. I mean, if you've got 20 or 50 robed Klansmen riding down the street with their Winchesters and masks, that's one thing. Halloween is another. But everyone knew what that law was for. But there's another one. Again, I'm surprised the gun people haven't picked up on this. But technically speaking, we had open carry in North Carolina at the time. I don't know what the law is like now, because I used to be an open carrier myself back in my younger, wilder days.
Yeah.
But there was also a law that they could use to arrest you. Basically, it was an anti-Klan law called going dangerously armed to the terror of the public. And that basically it allowed the cop to make a differentiation between a couple of guys going deer hunting out in the woods and 50 Klansmen are rolling down the street waving, you know, weapons in the air with dragging niggers behind their pickup trucks. Anyway, apparently this kid is going to be charged with 2 counts of inducing panic. 2 counts. Okay, so did he induce panic in 2 people?
That would be my guess.
Or did he induce panic twice on his Facebook page? Okay.
Well, he didn't make 2 posts there.
Okay. 1 count each of aggravated menacing. Okay, who was he menacing? Now, this is stupid.
So if you menace somebody but they don't panic, then you've only done one
but
illegal
thing? Who did they menace? My understanding is that in order to threaten somebody, you have to threaten somebody. You have to say, okay, I don't like John Jones. Monday morning, I'm going to go down to his house and beat him to death with a baseball bat or something specific. Or, I think this is how they got Bill White. I think, you know, Judge so-and-so needs to be killed or have their balls cut off or whatever. But threatening somebody specific in a credible manner. There is a legal doctrine of a credible threat, which is meant to allow serious prosecutors and serious lawyers to discount 17-year-old kids babbling on their Facebook page. But this kid is going to be charged with 2 counts of aggravated menacing. Who did he menace? Telecommunications harassment. Who did he harass?
He harassed Facebook.
Now, this actually is a little bit chilling because, okay, that looks like six charges and, oh, I'm sorry, four charges.
Four charges.
Two of inducing panic, one count of aggravated menacing, and one count of telecommunications harassment. Of course, they've taken down the page now, so we can't check. Did he actually menace anybody in particular, or did he just say, I feel like going on a stabbing spree? I mean, this is... Once again, they may be using this case, that little salami slicer tactic, as the communists call it. They slice our rights away, thin slice by thin slice. The parameters every year are reduced, shrunk just a little bit. It's almost like being in the trash compactor in Star Wars. The walls start closing in as to what you can do and can't. So apparently, this guy is being charged with threatening and menacing and inducing panic, but with no particular victim. You might want to follow this because this looks like it might have some significance for us. They keep looking for some way to shut us down by claiming that we're doing this or doing that. Or for many, many years, the system has looked for an end run around the First Amendment. It could be that this may be one more little step in the process of finding that end run around the Constitution that the government so badly wants. Of course, they've also thrown the Constitution out now. Obama now has the power to execute American citizens without trial. Obama now under the...
Patriot Act, too.
Well, that, whatever is that, National Defense Authorization Act, now has the power to lock people up without habeas corpus and without trial. So it's almost like he doesn't dare use it yet. Little things like this, where this kid can be charged with menacing and inducing panic, but no actual victim of the panic or the menacing is named. That could be significant. Anyway... Okay. California treasurer receives sex tape of wife with another man. That's just fascinating news.
Views it and watches and eats popcorn. It's California. What do you expect?
I'm surprised California still exists, some of their finances and their whole infrastructure and the way it is. Now, I understand that large parts of Central California are now, for all practical purposes, parts of Mexico, and they look like Mexico. You ride down the road, the potholes in the road, you see nothing but shanties full of beaners on either side of the road. Okay.
DNC chair to attend fundraiser hosted by man on terror watch list.
Is it Harold?
Well, I'm not on the no-fly list. I am on the watch list. I found this out about, well, about, you know, it was May of 2010 when I took that flight. Okay. Debbie's date with radicalism.
Yes.
Oh, that's Debbie Wasserman Schultz. She's the Jew who's the head of the Democratic National Committee.
I was going to say, a face like that, she's got to be a Jew.
Okay. Democrats and Republicans alike are wondering why Wasserman Schultz, described by the Jewish Daily Forward, which is a communist paper, by the way, as a proud Jewess, would associate with Muslim Brotherhood-backed group. Well, seeing as how Obama and the regime apparently has supported the Muslim Brotherhood and their revolutions in Egypt and Tunisia and Libya, including buggering Gaddafi on the burning sands before they killed him and things like that, I suppose he's off the watch list now if he's associated with the Muslim Brotherhood, since the Obama regime recognizes their three new revolutionary setups they've got over there. Also, it's interesting that Obama is threatening to bomb Syria and attack Bashar Assad and all that sort of stuff because he's being mean and shooting down his own people. That's another Muslim Brotherhood-inspired rebellion in Syria, and Obama is threatening to intervene on their side. So,
an interesting thing on that, the Syrian issue, I enjoy watching Live Leak because there's videos that are uploaded that are not, shall we say, cleansed by the mainstream media. And one of the videos that they had featured on their front page a few weeks ago was Syrian protesters who were posing in a way that made it look as if they had been blown up by the Syrian government. And so they were putting out videos that were false saying that, oh, the Syrian government's blown up this neighborhood and killed all these people. And it was just a bunch of guys playing dead.
Well, remember from the Spanish Civil War, there was supposedly a very famous air raid at Guernica, which is a village up in the Pyrenees Mountains, that the Nazi Condor Legion allegedly went in and bombed this defenseless village with Stukas, etc., etc. Pablo Picasso painted a ridiculous painting called Guernica, which is a bunch of eyes and hands and this sort of, I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen it. You know, I don't know if you've ever seen any Picasso's so-called artwork.
Seen the painting.
Yeah, right. But weird crap. Anyway, there was a massacre at Guernica, but it was not done by the Condor Legion. It was done several days before when the Republican, which in Spanish context meant the communist government troops, came in, wiped out the villagers, who were a bunch of Basque separatists, and it was kind of like Kurds, neither side liked them. The communist government troops went in, slaughtered all these people. They took some photographs of the bodies laid out nice and neat. Those photographs ended up being portrayed as air raid victims. And when the Condor Legion did come in and bomb the place, it was to get the communist troops out of there. But to this day, if you read the history of Guernica, it'll be about how all the defenseless villagers were massacred by the evil Nazi Stukas from the Condor Legion. I don't know how we got off onto that. Anyway.
People faking being bombed.
One prominent Jewish Democrat told the Washington Free Beacon that Wasserman Schultz's actions are troubling. Oh, she's actually treating a Muslim like a human being. Can't have that.
Aren't all Jewish actions troubling?
Yeah. I'm not sure how much money they will raise at this event, but there is no amount that is worth having the head of the Democratic Party associated with anyone who appears to have a soft spot for terrorism, the Democrat said, except, of course, for Barack Obama, who has a soft spot for terrorism. He hangs out with that guy Bill Ayers, whom I remember from the Weatherman days. And now it's time for another sad and tragic song of Irish immigration.
Maybe someday I'll go back again to Ireland, and my dear old wife would only pass away. She nearly has my heart broke with her nagging. He's got a mouth as big as Galway Bay. See her drinking 16 pints of Pabst Blue Ribbon. Commercial. And then she can walk home without a sway. If the sea was beer instead of salty water, she would live and die in Galway Bay. See her drinking 16 pints at Pat Joe Murphy's. The barman says, I think it's time to go. Well, she doesn't try to speak to him in Gaelic, in a language that the clergy do not know. On her back she has tattooed a map of Ireland, and when she takes her bath on Saturday, she rubs the sunlight soap around by Tlada, just to watch the suds flow down by Galway.
Last week, I had the honor of having my fiction reviewed on one of the major white nationalist websites by a European comrade who actually has the long string of degrees and accomplishments in life that are supposed to qualify someone to do book reviews. It was a very favorable review. It got me a lot of good feedback and exposure, and I thank him for it. However, what was interesting was not so much the review itself, but the reaction in the comments section when, as always occurs any time I or the Northwest Imperative are mentioned anywhere in the so-called mainstream movement, which practically speaking means on about a dozen websites and V-bulletin boards, since other than the NF, we're nothing but net these days. Anyway, as always occurs in these cases, three specific individuals immediately showed up. Now, this always happens within approximately 2 hours of any mention that I or the Northwest Front get on certain intellectual blogs and websites, and on certain V-bulletin boards. Now, either these individuals literally sit at their computers every day, all day, and do nothing but look for my name on the internet, or else they've got some kind of tracking and stalking software that sweeps the internet looking for keywords like Covington and Brigade and Northwest. Anyway, as is their usual practice, using both their own names and at least one internet sock puppet or false ID apiece, these loons immediately began to flood the comments section with
space madness,
hysterical posts denouncing me for every wicked deed under the sun and telling the whole world what a foul character I am and how the Northwest Migration can't possibly work and under no circumstances must anyone support the NF or discuss my work in public, so forth and so on, since that would quote-unquote give Covington credibility. Apparently, I'm just a horrible wee man altogether, so I am. Now, I'm not going to try and refute these goat dancers because what they say can't be refuted. It's just mindless abuse or screaming, frothing references to things that happened back in the nutty 90s or even the 1970s, most of which, incidentally, never actually happened in any way, shape, or form resembling their version of events, and some of which never happened at all. I can't prove a negative. I can't prove that something did not happen in 1992 or that I did not do something in 1978, and I have no intention of trying to play their game. But what is always more significant to me than what these wankers say is what they don't say. Now, does anyone besides me ever notice that my critics, not only goat dancers, but semi-legitimate critics as well, never ever propose any kind of alternative plan to the Northwest Imperative? They just scream and sob that it will never work and you mustn't listen to that wicked man Harold Covington who will lead you astray down the garden path or whatever. Now, I am kind of unique in the white nationalist movement in that I have never bought into this strange idea we have that to articulate a problem is the same as to solve it. We have spent the past 70 years in endless discussion and debate and analysis of the problem. Other than my own work, what this movement has actually said in a serious way about the solution could be put into a teacup. This, of course, is because we have all known for many decades what the solution is. We also know that we are too timid and frightened to apply that solution. The big bad policeman and the terrible thing in the black robe might hurt us if we actually try to change anything. And of course they might, unless we can shoot faster and straighter. No man likes to admit to himself that he's a drop of chicken shit on the ground in the Jews' kosher barnyard. And this self-knowledge makes us feel absolutely terrible about ourselves. And so we ooze around the edges of the situation, talking to ourselves, calming ourselves, making up all kinds of very sound excuses and very carefully rationalizing out some version of things whereby we're not really cowardly turds who are selling our own children into slavery and desolation. Oh, no, 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 no. It's just the time isn't right. It's just this. It's just that. It's basically, it's just if we wait long enough, somebody else will step forward and do it. Okay, now that's happened. Here I am. Not in the sense that I'm going to strap an explosive vest on and blow up a synagogue, but even if they kick in my door and drag me away to an undisclosed location tomorrow at dawn, I've accomplished my primary objective. The taboo on white people actually speaking of genuine change is now broken, and the plan is now out there and clear enough. I should know. I've spent the past 10 years and 5 long novels explaining it. So, you no longer have the excuse that no one has stepped forward. I have. And it scares some of you shitless. A small number of you have, I think, literally gone insane with rage and jealousy and incomprehension that a small group of white people here in the Northwest, and I do not refer just to myself, have taken the first step without you and without your favorite guru from the 1990s or whenever. No one else has a plan. No one else has ever had a plan. Well, let me walk that back a bit. Pierce did have a kind of a half-assed plan, except he never revealed it to much of anybody. Now, I have the honor to count among my friends and supporters a number of men who were very close to the late Dr. William Pierce at various points in his career. And one of them told me that once on a visit to Hillsboro, he really put the screws to Pierce and more or less demanded to get a peek at the big picture, just where the whole National Alliance thing was headed and what it was all in aid of. And he finally managed to get an answer, sort of. To sum it up, Pierce's plan was, first off, to produce the best, most intelligent, and convincing racial propaganda he could produce. In this, I have to say, he probably succeeded. Pierce's work is the best we've ever seen in the movement at the top end, the intellectual elite end, and yes, if it makes some of you happy, I will freely concede that most of Pierce's theoretical and polemic writing was better than mine. He produced what was unquestionably the best periodical that the movement has ever issued, although he could seldom bring it out on time. But when National Vanguard came out, it was superb. Beyond that, though, as Pierce told our comrade, his strategy was vague, although he did have one. He wanted to get this great propaganda into the hands of the remaining white men in the system who still had power. I presume he meant military officers, maybe a handful of judges and legislators and senior civil servants, and above all, wealthy men, millionaires and billionaires who had the money to buy power, meaning in the long run, buy guns and buy fingers willing to pull the triggers. As Napoleon once said, revolution is an idea that's found bayonets. Pierce wanted to convert and motivate the men who could buy the bayonets. Now, once this small, nebulous circle of white men with real power somehow awakened and got together and got organized, they would then stage what I suppose might be called a palace coup against the government and the liberal media and the Jews, so forth and so on. Okay, I can see this plan. I can understand it. I won't even comment on it here. I'll let you guys mull it over and see what you think of it. Let me know. But I will say this. This highlights what was probably the biggest difference between myself and William Pierce as revolutionary thinkers, if you want to call either of us that. Pierce never believed that a white revolution could come from below. His contempt for normal white people was simply too complete, too ingrained. To Pierce, revolution would have to come, if at all, from what K.G. Holm called the in-elites. Me, I still think it's possible for revolution to come from properly organized and motivated white out-elites, although don't ask me why. Yes, I admit it, the evidence appears to be stacked against me. Yet, to my surprise, hell, sometimes to my utter astonishment, after 40 years of this bullshit, I still have hope. God knows why. It seems to be hardwired into me. No, there will never be any modern-day equivalent of Hitler's NSDAP with millions of card-carrying members in long brown columns marching down American streets singing stirring anthems. That was our great-grandfathers, not us. But I believe that it is, in fact, possible to recruit and organize and motivate a small and dedicated minority to bring about genuine change. Every week, you listen to this program and you log off and do nothing until it's time to tune in again next week. You prove me wrong. But I keep trying. In fact, I'll try again next week. Radio Free Northwest is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98104, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.